Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Our position is a little bit like England was, or Great Britain was in Europe in the early modern, much of the modern period. That's kind of how we are. And we're a democracy, when we're very rich. So our best is high technology, things where that kind of dominates. Ground warfare often, even in the modern era, can often come down to, you know, guys on the ground with guns duking it out. I mean, I'm not the world's expert by any stretch, but I think, you know, our army is very good, has a lot of capability. But the thing that really matters in what I'm talking about dealing with China is naval warfare and aerospace, and I'm talking air up into outer space. That is our wheelhouse, and we've lost the bubble on that. I mean, one of the things when I talk to military audiences, I often say, look. In this day and age, the famous movies people watch about the military are about Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. But what we really want is to go back to the 1980s, where the most famous movie about the military was about a guy going to training school, Top Gun.
Yep.
Right? I mean, that's what people should be going and doing, is training their butts off to go toe-to-toe with the best of the best of the best, to quote, you know, Iceman or whoever said it in Top Gun. But I think that's what we want. But that is where we're good.
Sagar and I have spent, and are going to continue to spend, lots of time thinking about America's foreign policy after the withdrawal from Afghanistan and last weekend's 20th anniversary of 9/11. A good way of summing up this season, through the end of the year, and frankly the vast majority of our episodes since we launched in 2019, has been the two of us looking at what exactly happened and went wrong with America and the world after the 1990s. Moving forward, and especially next year, we're going to focus on where to go next. Today's episode is the perfect mix of both of these themes. We're covering the idea of great power conflict. The last 20 years have been about dealing with the consequences of an uber-powered post-9/11 America overreaching itself. The next 20 are going to be about reckoning with a world where the U.S. faces competitors and challenges unlike anything we saw during the War on Terror, especially in the Asia-Pacific region with China. Sagar, who are we speaking to about this topic?
Yeah, we've got Elbridge Colby. He's the co-founder, principal of the Marathon Initiative. So Elbridge actually served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Trump administration from 2017 to 2018. He led the National Defense Strategy, and he just released his first book. It's called The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. Elbridge, or Bridge, as he prefers to be called, is somebody who is a really forward-thinking person. He is not doctrinaire. Thinking deeply about China, thinking about how we must leave Afghanistan, the Middle East, even possibly withdraw from some of our posture in Europe, because he wants to focus and reorient Americans towards great power competition with China. So he's not a hawk. He's also not a dove, not somebody easy to place, and somebody who I think is really leading the conversation in the correct direction.
Yeah, and if anyone is looking to get a preview of his thought and aren't going to spend their money on a book right away, we both really recommend a New Yorker piece about him written by Benjamin Wallace Wells. It's called Will the Next American War Be with China? It is linked in the show notes, unlike that great article that Adam Tooze wrote last week that a bunch of you all tweeted about. We'll make sure to put that in the Substack as well, too. But a good way to just sum this up is we're not trying to tell everyone how to think about the era of great power competition. The whole idea here is that you could either be for or against the war on terror, you could oppose or support the war in Iraq. The point was, all of our decisions with foreign policy and domestic policy to a certain amount actually revolved around that framework. So that's the general idea here. Bridges on the right, but as he makes clear during the episode, everyone is going to have something they're going to have to respond to, regardless of how they feel about that. And one last quick note, during this episode, I said one of those things which you say, Sagar, I know you do this too in your own show as well. You say it, you're like, man, there's just a fourth of the audience that's just going to be really ticked off about that. And I just want to say up front, I make these comments about the military industrial complex. And I got a little aggressive of saying, Bridge, obviously, nothing that we do of foreign policy has to do with payments under the table or corruption. That's an overstatement. There are structures, there are systems, there's soft corruption, there's hard corruption. The idea that I was trying to get at, and that I really believe here, is that too often when we're talking about these subjects, there's too much bad faith in terms of assuming why people believe the things that they feel. Sagar and I think what we think about foreign policy, China, this topic, etc. not because someone's paying us, because we got a fellowship, because it's what we actually believe. So if you have beef with us, that's great. Tweet at us right into the show. We love those comments. But what I was trying to get across with my military industrial complex point is that we're not believing these things because of that type of soft corruption. And it gets really frustrating there. But a lot of really great stuff here.
Yeah, look, it's funny. I actually argue that if it was just as easy as stopping a flow of money, that would be better than the current situation. The situation's worse. These people actually believe it. Yes, many of them get paid. Absolutely. The money is a huge part of the story. But the chief building block of it is an ideology, which is universities, think tanks within the government, removal, the fact that foreign policy itself is an elite discipline, which is why that how elites think about certain individuals and matters and stuff matters probably more than in any other sphere. That's what undergirds everything. That's what pushes to the disasters of the war in Iraq, the occupation long-term of Afghanistan, and ultimately what's keeping us from what I believe is our largest peer competition threat that we've seen in over 100 years, and that's China. And that's something that Bridge, I think, does an excellent job of kind of squaring the circle there. And look, it's funny because there's not a lot of money in confronting China. There's sometimes that's leveled against us, Marshall. Last time I checked, all the corporations are sold out to China, or they want to do business with China. So a war with China would actually be dramatically counterproductive to any of their economic needs. But look, when your brain has been powered by Howard Zinn, I guess I'm just asking too much in order whenever you ask some hard questions.
Quick last way to sum this up. We're going a little really long on this one because we're doing a lot of foreign policy here. So I know this is just going to keep coming up over the next coming months. So a good way of summing up Sagar, my position is if you think we are too hawkish on China, if you think that I am too apologetic for the military elite policy class, come at us with ideas. Come at us with, Marshall, you're wrong about this. Sagar, you're wrong about that. Don't do this bad faith thing where we only believe what we want because of a weird fellowship that doesn't actually give you that much money. That's the type of faith we're looking for from the audience. Before we jump into this episode, of course, a lot of great stuff here. A huge thank you, speaking of sponsors, to Lincoln Network for supporting our work and making sure we could do it with integrity and the knowledge that you all will support us no matter what editorial stance we take on these issues. Great stuff here. Let's get into the episode. Elbridge Colby, welcome to The Realignment.
Great. Delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. It feels like we are at a transition point in history, not merely because last week was the 20th anniversary of September 11th, but because that anniversary by design coincided with a U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and a general clear repositioning of our foreign policy priorities and how we're really defining the legacy of the past 20 years. Let's start by just getting your definition of this really specific moment, because this podcast is called The Realignment. It feels like it's a realignment of sorts, but from your personal perspective, how do you think about this moment?
Well, I think it is a significant transition. I mean, we've been going through something for the last few years, but I think the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and frankly, the debacle of the actual withdrawal, but I think it was the right decision to get out, does kind of mark a pretty significant turning point. I mean, personally, I think you had Ross on last week, and I mean, I was listening to some of what he was saying. I can remember driving into college on 9/11, to register. And I can remember being in Iraq as a junior civilian. And, you know, we're 20 years on now. And I think people are really looking to a different moment. And more importantly, we really need to, not only because a lot of what we did was fundamentally ill-advised and ill-founded kind of conceptually and politically, but also because the rise of China is just by far the most fundamental fact, certainly outside of our own borders, that we have to reckon with. And we are way behind already.
You know, it's interesting, Bridge, when in that interview with Ross, you mentioned, which happened when Marshall co-hosted Breaking Points, he mentioned you by name, saying that he believed really in the case for the war in Iraq and that he had a friend who was you working at the State Department who was like, this is not going to work out. It's going to be a total disaster, which in my eyes gives you immense credibility on anything you'll say for the future. So take us back exactly to that moment. Why were you able to see clearly what other people weren't able to see? And what do you think that that mindset is important for applying to some of the stuff we're going to talk about a little bit later on?
Yeah, no, thanks. I mean, first off, I should say I've been wrong about a lot of things, including many important things. So, I think I was right on this one, but it doesn't, I'm far from unerring, very far. But I will say, I think Ross actually referred to me as sort of a hyper-realist, which I guess I would fess up to. But I remember when we were working together on the college newspaper, the college conservative newspaper, at that time, even I was against the intervention in Kosovo. So, I mean, I was almost, I wouldn't say reflexive, but I was pretty strong in that direction. I had, I think, an aversion to the sort of use of the military and the use of American power for these very aggressive, essentially liberal or neoliberal global aims. And I think I also had, I had already become interested in the sort of the Cold War and the history of how we dealt with that. I'd studied or read a lot about Vietnam when I was young for, shows how much, how popular I was. But I think I had maybe a little bit of a sense of the limits of American military power and sort of political, strategic power beyond our borders. And, in fairness, I would get in these titanic arguments with another friend of Ross and mine, who's now a successful lawyer, but at the time was one of the key proteges under Jerry Bremer. And he was a real true believer in the Iraq mission and liberalizing, I would say, the sort of like strong sort of neo-Reaganite view. And he and I would have these huge tussles that I think get into a lot of the issues that you guys have been plumbing. And I'm certainly on your side of that ledger, or that divide conceptually and politically. But it was that I think I also was inchoately more without clearly understanding in the way that you guys have fleshed out some of the ideas of, frankly, that the original neoconservatives, I mean, that was one of the things that was really striking at the time, is there was sort of a generational sociological element. I mean, I would read people like Daniel Bell or Irving Kristol or the early public interest stuff. And that was like, well, wait, state power limits on what it can accomplish, both at home and abroad. Great society, not going to work out exactly how you want. Nation building in Vietnam may not be as successful as you think. And then we found ourselves in the late 90s, early 2000s, really in a hubristic situation. I mean, and that's, one of the areas where I think the kind of realist disposition, because I think it's in some sense more of a disposition than it is always so conceptual, tells you to say, like, if there's no checks on your power, you will tend to make mistakes. You will tend to think that things that really aren't a good idea are a good idea. And that in some sense was what happened. And I think, we're still paying the price. But I mean, even being in Iraq, again, as a junior civilian on the State Department side, I mean, it was remarkable how thoroughgoing those beliefs were at the Coalition Provisional Authority, at the Occupation Authority in Baghdad. I mean, they really believed it, I think, a lot of people. And, I think, again, we're seeing the results. I mean, it's been a tremendous failure. And I think that was really goes back to the roots of it.
Before Sagar takes us to great power competition, which is the main thrust of the forward facing part of this podcast, I want to hit two things that you hit in your biography and story there that are really, really important that I want listeners, especially younger ones who weren't even alive during 9/11, to really conceive of. So part one, you specifically said you were against the Kosovo intervention. And something Sagar and I have talked a lot about is we've noticed this really frustrating tendency on the younger parts of the right to look at Afghanistan and say things like, oh man, why'd we even get into this? This is really dumb. Nation building is bad. We're never going to do this again. And something I pointed out is, hey, it sounds like you really would have liked George W. Bush when he ran for president in 2000. Yeah. And it sounds like you were right there too. You read Condoleezza Rice's Foreign Affairs article in Bush's name. And you're like, exactly. Great, this is awesome. Yeah. Why did you retain that skepticism in the face of 9/11? Mm-hmm. Because that's the key, because this is the interesting story here. I hate when people try to reduce the story of George W. Bush to neocons and weapons controls, because it's like, no. Something happened on 9/12. Why didn't that thing happen to you?
Well, let me say, I remember I actually interned in the White House in the summer of 2001. And I think some of those neoconservative beliefs were already present. I mean, I don't know President Bush. I mean, he's obviously a very fine human being by all accounts and very accomplished and so forth. But I think he didn't have a clear, intellectual superstructure, to use. And I mean, I think that's pretty evident. But I say that White House internship because I went to a speech to all the interns by Condoleezza Rice. And this was like in July or August of 2001, so before 9/11. And the speech she gave, I don't remember it particularly well, but I remember it being essentially a kind of a bolderized Fukuyama, right? That we're going to go around and bring about the end of history. And that's the kind of logic that you would get from the Weekly Standard and the Crystal and the Frums and so forth. And I think the reason that I didn't fall for that is, I mean, honestly, I think I genuinely am a conservative. And that's actually very rare in the foreign policy elite for a long time, even today. But I think what happened is, in some sense, starting with Reagan, but certainly after the end of the Cold War, Republican foreign policy people were hawks. They're often socially liberal. They're not particularly aligned with the party. They're certainly not, common good conservatives or populist or whatever. They just basically are hawks, which is sort of, Trotsky and Lenin were hawks and, Robespierre was a hawk. So there's no necessary connection between being a hawk and a dove. And I think I'm actually a conservative. I mean, I read, obviously Burke and stuff like that. But I mean, the conservative canon broadly construed, I mean, going back to the Greeks and all that, I mean, not to belabor the point. But I mean, I think that was actually a deeply, and I go back to say my good friend with whom we would have these arguments, who's now the lawyer who worked for Bremer. And, he's a conservative in this sort of American sense of the 1990s and 2000s. And that's great. They need to be part of our coalition and so forth. But I think he would be more of like a classical liberal. And so the classical liberals were more prone to get carried away, I think. And I mean, I think you're right that there were other reasons. It's not like there was some cabal of neocons who or the defense contractor thing. I mean, I think there were a number of reasons that flowed together to drive the Iraq war decision and how it was implemented and so forth. But I think that's sort of where, and I think, in the book I have coming out, I mean, I try to bring that. It's realist, but I kind of think of realism and conservatism as being sort of dispositionally cognate. I mean, they basically are sort of, look, things are complicated and hard to pull off. Grand designs tend to not go very well. Your primary responsibility is your immediate surroundings, your family, your community, your country, and you work out from there. They're pretty similar. And, people can be bad if given the wrong set of incentives. And so that's the sort of, again, I think I probably made mistakes in the other direction because of those, or I know I've made mistakes in the other direction because of those. But I think on Iraq, it set me in at least in the right direction.
And then the other follow up here, too, is you specifically stated that your colleagues at the Coalition of Provisional Authority actually believed what they believed, because the most frustrating part of the Afghan war ending discourse has really been, once again, of younger listeners who, because they weren't alive during 9/11 and because everything went so crazy over the course of those next subsequent 20 years, it seems so insane that the only simplest Occam's razor reason why it happened was defense contractors. Yeah. Raytheon, those more conspiratorial things where, I've seen a huge amount of people start pushing Smedley Butler, war is a racket type posts under our YouTube comments more and more and more, which is really frustrating because I think Smedley Butler was totally wrong. We did not enter World War I because of weapons contractors. And by the way, reading Smedley Butler in 1933 was the last thing you should have read leading up to World War II. So I really hope people understand that part here. But I'm bringing this up because what I don't want to have happen is I don't want people to hear the China part of our conversation and think to themselves, well, listen, Bridge and Marshall and Sagar are getting paid by Raytheon under the table because they want, shipbuilding contract. I maybe I'm naive here. I just do not think you could look at the historical record, look at the actual parts of this process and actually think maybe there are perverse incentives. I could agree to that, but there is just no way that a lobbyist is handing people checks. And then that leads to foreign policy, straightforward decisions and viewpoints. So can you speak to why people believe what they believe, even if they're wrong in these contexts?
I think you're absolutely right. I 100% agree with you. And look, I mean, the defense companies exist. My experience of the defense companies is that they tend to be kind of small C conservative. They don't want to rock the boat. They like predictable. Yeah. They're highly regulated. They're like the big three auto companies. They don't like change. I don't know what they were. I wasn't kind of senior at that point. Like, I don't know what they were thinking about the Iraq thing. On that sort of thing, I think the defense companies go along to get along, to stay predictable and to meet their quarterly earnings and so forth. They're not the drivers by any stretch of the imagination. That's not to say that they're innocent or or that they don't need serious scrutiny, for sure. But they're not a primary driver at all. I think it really was. Look, I think that the fundamental structural reason was, and I appreciate your point about China, because I do think it is different. But I think the fundamental structural reason was that unipolarity, basically not having any constraints, made us stupid. And there's a great Burke quote. I keep this running list of quotations, and one of them is Burke saying, I think it was in the context of the East India Company prosecutions and stuff. But he said, you know, I fear not only others having too much power, I fear ourselves. And that's where I think Bill Barr actually said something really, I think, on point on this in a speech he gave last year. He said the core of the American Constitution is not really the Bill of Rights. It's the separation of powers, because our system is predicated on the idea that if you have too much power, you will, you know, absolute power corrupts. And it makes you, it actually makes you stupid. And I think, you know, that we were so, in a sense, it's hard to harken back because people who are younger, they've grown up in this, in a kind of, there's sort of this miasma of failure and constraint and the financial crisis. At the time, it was like this, anything was possible. And it was, anything was possible. And it seemed like it was inevitable that the world would all turn into Western Europe. So those two things, it was kind of like, and the other thing, you know, I mentioned the CPA people. You have to think, like, I think a lot of the decision makers had really over-internalized both, like, the end of the Cold War as this kind of victory, and they felt they had been vindicated even though they were the dissenters. But also, like, almost like World War II, you know, old World War II movies where the, you know, the Allies drive into, like, some Dutch town and they're mobbed, you know, because right. Everybody wants democracy. Culture doesn't really matter. Culture's nice for, like, you know, you have your annual ethnic parade or whatever, but really it doesn't matter. These things don't matter. And I think you're absolutely right. And so I appreciate, Marshall, you're making this point, because I was accused of being a dove. I mean, I was lambasted by many from the hawk side for my positions, like on Iran, and for instance, and I support the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And then I get people call me a China hawk on the other side. To me, hawk and dove are contextual. You know, it depends. You know, sometimes you should be a hawk, sometimes you should be a dove, like the Federal Reserve. Sometimes it should, I guess, be a hawk or a dove on currency, right? Depends on the situation.
Exactly.
So that's kind of my view.
That's very important for the context. And we'll get to now your forthcoming book, The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. You know, in the more recent New Yorker piece that was kind of talking about the book, I would say the meta point that you're just trying to make is, hey, like, we are in and should believe in great power conflict. So can you make that case vis-a-vis the United States and China? I think people do intuitively understand this. We know that we're in some form, but the degree to what that is supposed to manifest and look like, especially given the fact that it's not going to be like the Soviet Union, and maybe it should be, you can tell us why. Like, what is great power conflict? Why are we in it? Why should we think about it? And how is it going to look differently than the last time that we were in it?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, not to keep quoting Trotsky, but he said, you know, you may not be interested in the revolution, but the revolution may be interested in you. I mean, so, you know, look, I think, you know, I use the phrase, China's rise is like the emergence of a huge planet in a solar system. It will exert a gravitational force. And yep. Huge states, just like in internal political system, or a market, huge states that emerge, or basically, you know, great powers that emerge from being smaller powers, they will exert themselves and assert themselves, because in frankly, in many ways, similar to what happened 20 years ago here, new things will become possible. I mean, the example I use is, I mean, there was a book a few years ago about China called The Age of Ambition. 50 years ago, people in China were glad to be alive after the Great Leap Forward, the Civil War, the Cultural Revolution, famine, et cetera. Now, the new generation of Chinese, upcoming generations, they've grown up with prosperity, rising expectations. They want more. That's natural human behavior. And China is very, very, very strong. So regardless of what we think or decide, China will assert itself. And it already is. I mean, don't ask me. Just look out at the news. I think the other thing is, it really matters for Americans. And I think you guys are really at the leading edge of describing what I'm trying to get at here, which is that really important powers shape the world or regions, but the world in which we live, including your economically, your job security, who sets the norms, and then ultimately for your freedoms. I mean, look at what I think people like us on the conservative side are very worried about, the agglomeration of the social media companies and our own government. Mm-hmm. Now imagine what the Chinese government, plus if it had dominant market share and regulatory power, over social media and what you would be allowed and not allowed to say and so forth on social media, whether you could hold your job, what your social capital score. This is the kind of world that we are already in, actually. The Chinese are exercising this kind of leverage over Australia right now, which, you know, in a lot of ways resembles American society in many ways. So I think this is what it's like. I would say the biggest kind of point that I would make, I think people, certainly in the foreign policy discussion, and I think actually in a way, people outside of the blob are more attuned to how significant China is in a way more than the blob. I mean, the blob is sort of insulated from, obviously, and this is one of the reasons for its flaws, is that, you know, I think people out in America recognize the economic competition, recognize that China has deliberately deindustrialized and brought industrial share and market share back to China. So they get it. Whereas the blob, you know, you kind of go to your think tank job or your government job or whatever. It's much more insulated. So I think people get that. My big point here is that the military piece is going to be much more important than a lot of people think, certainly than the Biden administration thinks. And that's for a variety of reasons, but that make it very real, including in this decade. And my instincts, Marshall, to go back to your early point, my instincts are not to get in foreign wars, generally speaking. Like, I would rather fight no wars. But again, like the Fed, I think the way you get to no foreign wars is not by being as dovish as possible, because it's a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. If you're too dovish, you incentivize aggressive behavior they'd eventually have to confront on less favorable terms. And so what I'm trying to do is get to that right equilibrium point where the Chinese understand, don't push it, and we're in a position, we and our allies are in a position where we can have a stable basis for detente.
Yeah.
I want you to speak to the uses and abuses of history when we're talking about these types of concepts, because, you know, you referred to the fact that, you know, we do a lot of like right-leaning things here, but we do actually have like a broad-based audience. And you really hit this in the New Yorker piece where it's like, look, it doesn't matter if you're left, right, center, anarcho-capitalist, communist, whatever. Right. This is here.
Yeah.
The question for everyone in the audience is, what are you going to do about it? And given that context, I think the best thing we can do is give people a useful way of conceptualizing these things. So I want to throw out a couple examples and then have you comment at a meta level. So for example, it'd be very easy for me to say, look, here's why Taiwan matters. This is just like Berlin in 1961. And the question is Joe Biden or Kamala Harris, are they going to blink or are they not going to blink? Mm-hmm. That suggests a certain course of action. If I were to say, hey, this is just like the 1930s and this is a concern about appeasement, I've dunked on Smedley Butler there, but just as someone could abuse Smedley Butler, I could also abuse Smedley Butler as well, too, which I could say anybody who's skeptical of what I'm saying about the world is inherently going to lead us to a World War II style conflict, where the more obvious answer in the 30s would have been, like you said, hawkishness in a weird way could have actually been a much more dovish in the long term approach to Hitler than just pure appeasement. So can you speak to that and then speak to empire? Because another part that critics to our left, I think, don't quite conceptualize is they have this Howard Zinn style conception of the world where everything in American foreign policy, especially after 1945, comes down to there's Washington, there's the Washington Consensus, everything is basically on us. I don't think people on the left have conceived of the fact that there is now another capital that has its own chessboard that it is actually playing and has its own vote. So those are the broad things I'd love you to respond to.
Well, I think I actually can tie it together up front, which is to say, as you can, I think, can tell, I am a you know, committed, serious conservative. But I think this book should be of interest to essentially everybody in the American political spectrum, and frankly, our allies and partners, because the purpose of the book here is not to advance conservative principles as such, although I hope those triumph in our domestic domestic scene, but rather the goal here is to allow us as Americans to determine our own future, to have the autonomy to do that, and to fight out, metaphorically, of course, fight out our debates on our own terms, not under the shadow of the military and economic coercion of China. And that's the rest. And to go back to the, some, to bring in the historical thing, you weren't making independent choices in Czechoslovakia, Poland, or Hungary in the Cold War. There was a shadow of economic and political and military domination that you had to, and that's the future. I mean, that's extreme, but that's the future that we could see. There are many shades of sort of domination or hegemony that we could fall under, especially if China goes and becomes powerful. And that's a point I really wanted to emphasize to Ben Wallace Wells, and I think I was glad he put it in the piece, that this is not a conservative book. In fact, most of the blurbers in the book are probably Democrats or kind of, you know, centrist types, but rather a book that's designed to basically appeal, be structured so that we can have our own debates. To your second point about history, I really agree with you about this point. I think, and actually, frankly, not to keep beating up on them, but I mean, the advocates say of Iraq and in the 1990s and 2000s, I mean, they would constantly be going back to the Munich analogy. But look, for every Munich analogy, there's a 1914 analogy. Did that war need to happen? Did Vietnam need to happen? I don't think so. I mean, it certainly didn't need to happen the way it did. And this gets back into this Fed metaphor. You can go too far or too short. And it's if you're always going in one direction, you're definitely going to make mistakes. So, and actually, one of the things I hope to do in kind of my engagements on all this is look, like, for instance, Taiwan is not a clear-cut case. In fact, the reason I focus on Taiwan is precisely because it's not a clear-cut case. There are good reasons why we might want to abandon it. But I think it's like a 70-30 kind of decision. But when you have a 70-30 decision, then you want your military position to be as strong as humanly possible. One of the things I do think history is very useful, though, because you know it gives some texture and some reality to these things. I think that probably the closest analogy, and again, it's imperfect, but again, I think it is useful, is probably to Germany or Prussia in the mid-19th century, which was a power that went from being, you know, Prussia in after the Napoleonic Wars was pretty low and beaten down, and it industrialized more quickly or modernized more quickly. And then under Bismarck, I mean, really in the space of 10 years, it went from being one power among several to being very close to the dominant power in Europe. And that was through three sharp, focused wars, first against the Danes, then against the Austrians, and then against the French. And suddenly, boom, you're in a whole different situation. And I think that's the kind of idea that we should be thinking about. And the Chinese have studied the Germans quite a lot, actually. And I think that's where the, you know, to link into the empire piece. I mean, look, I think I actually like a lot of the kind of hard left critiques of empire because there's, you know, this sort of classical liberal strain in American foreign policy, you know, sort of acts as if we're immune, you know, we're always innocent. Our intentions are always good. I mean, if you visit the Mexican War Museum in Mexico City, they don't think we were the good guys, right? I mean, I think we're the best country in the world. I love my country, but we're not perfect. And we do behave like other states. I mean, we expanded. I mean, if you wanted an example of a state that progressively attained regional hegemony, the best example is probably the United States in the 19th century, right? So that was like, we did pretty well. But I think that the defect there is that these forms of behavior are going to happen. And ultimately, geopolitics and really military force are going to be dominant. This is a point I'm trying to balance because we're so used to being militarily dominant that people don't think like a war with China or Russia is possible that's because we've lived in this world for the last 30 years where anybody who got in a serious war with it would get their tail kicked. That's no longer the case anymore. And that's not the natural way that politics goes. But at the end of the day, as Mao said, power comes from a barrel of a gun, right? And if China is able to use weapons and force to get its way, we can have all the cultural power, all the ideological power we want, but it ain't going to matter because people ultimately are going to want to live, right? I mean, you go to the hierarchy of needs. And so I think the problem there is like we have to live in a world where we have to agglomerate our own coalition. I'm anti-imperial by preference. You know, like I don't want to have, I would probably give up all of our, you know, most of our territories other than in the Pacific Islands and so forth. But I think, you know, the reality is that we have to also operate in a geopolitical context in which other countries look for reassurance, might decide they want to kowtow to the Chinese, et cetera. And that's the decisive thing. So if we're going to deal with these imperialist tendencies, we got to do it from a realistic position of how the world actually works.
Just to channel the most crude form of the argument, especially because in the New Yorker piece, you specifically say, not only do we need to withdraw from the Middle East, we actually need to tamp down our commitments in Europe. And to borrow, I think it's Stephen Walt, you know, the classic thing, why should I die for Taipei and not for Kiev under your framework? Like, why is Taipei and Taiwan more strategic, worthy of American blood than the city of Kiev in Ukraine, which has not quite a NATO commitment, but, you know, something quasi? What is the strategic rationale behind that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for the American people, I would never ask the American people for die to others on its own sake. So it has nothing to do with the people on Taiwan. It has to do with a couple things. One, Asia is the world's largest market area. It's going to be roughly 50% in the coming years. So any state that dominated that region and could set those rules I talked about earlier, they will direct your life, your economic security, your job, ultimately your liberties at home. So that's what we have to impose. Europe is a distant second. It's like 25%, it's declining. It's important, it's the secondary theater from our point of view. Middle East, not that important. Persian Gulf is particularly important because of oil, but it's much, much farther behind. The second reason is China, it could actually dominate Asia. It's half of Asia's GDP, roughly. So it's a realistic prospect. There's no way Russia is going to dominate Europe. It's possible that Russia could seize the Baltic states, parts of Poland, maybe Romania, Ukraine, but they're going to stall out. I mean, the other countries that are part of NATO, Germany, France, et cetera, they would block. So the worst case in Europe is far behind. So we basically have a situation where the most important theater is also the one that's most jeopardized by an aspiring hegemon. Why is Taiwan important? Taiwan is important because for us, from a brass tacks point of view, it's militarily significant. Look, our wheelhouse is the sea and the air and space, technology type stuff. We're a democracy. If you go, there's a lot of reverse nostalgia about World War II. I have relatives who fought in World War II and stuff. I honor the Americans who served and sacrificed. But the Soviets lost, what, I think, was it 10? No, sorry, 100, roughly 50 times the number of people that we did in the Cold War. And this is not, I mean, this is a point that Putin makes that, like, okay, this is not about the political stuff.
Why that Molotov-Ribbentrop? I hate when Russian people do that. It's like, what happened two years before that?
Right, exactly. No. The Soviets have, awful. But they, you know, I mean, just the amount of, you know, putting people into the meat grinder that they did. I mean, apparently, I saw this on Twitter the other day, the Soviets shot 15,000 of their own people in Stalingrad who retreated from the front line without authorization. We had a huge controversy to hang one guy who was a deserter. That's right. Good. That's this kind of society in which we want to live. But that basically means we're best off at high technology, aerospace, maritime. So don't get in a land war in Asia, right? That's our, you know, Vietnam, Korea, bad. Certainly don't get fighting with the Chinese in Southeast Asia if we can possibly avoid it. But that makes it all the more important that we hold our defense line in the Western Pacific, because that's where a lot of the wealth is. Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, Philippines, Indonesia, et cetera, right? So that's one thing, that military significance is important, because if the Chinese took that island, their military could project out into the Central Pacific, really undermine the military position of Japan, Philippines, et cetera. Second is our credibility. Hawks love to talk about credibility. I have a kind of a moderate vision of credibility, which is kind of intuitive. Look, there's a big academic debate about whether credibility matters. I mean, we all know credibility matters. If you want to buy a home, if you want to buy a car, you get a credit check, right? So credit matters, but it's not like an undifferentiated thing. Credibility matters. Like, if you're in Japan and the Americans don't fight to defend Taiwan, well, that tells you something. Yeah. If the Americans get out of Afghanistan, that tells you something different. In fact, it might even strengthen your confidence in Japan, because it says, oh, they actually have the discipline to be focused on Asia. I don't necessarily think that's what the Biden team is doing, but, you know, those are two different things. I mean, you can maybe cheat at cards and pay down your rental, your mortgage, right? Those are two different things. So I think but that's also important. And even though we don't have a treaty commitment to Taiwan, everybody in the region, which is what matters from this point of view, sees it as a canary in the coal mine. These are strong arguments. They're not cut and dried. They're not open and shut, though. And that's why I'm so focused on having our military focus, because the better our military is at the problem, the less the American people have to suffer and risk to vindicate it. And that puts us in a better position.
I want to go back to the Germany historical analogy, because it's a very useful one. Because if you look at that history post 1871, so after the Franco-Prussian War, Germany unites with Bismarck, the Kaiser, basically everything moving forward goes disastrously, in the sense that Germany, they become a scientific and educational power. They create all these new models for the, like, you know, education systems, medical systems. So that's also where the China analogy also works too. But they go on a massive naval shipbuilding program, which leads to competition with the Anglo world. You then have World War I, that ends badly for Germany, then leads to World War II, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Every single point, it's basically handled. The British Empire gets knocked out, but they manage to limp to the finish line, and Germany, especially in 1871, doesn't win. What lessons have the Chinese taken from the Prussia story you've told? And what lessons should we take from how the Allied end mismanaged or mishandled that process?
Yeah, great question. The Chinese, when we say the Chinese, obviously there are a lot of people in China. So I think some Chinese are acutely aware that what the problem that the failure of German policy, particularly after the dismissal of Bismarck, I guess in the 1880s, was too much aggressiveness. They basically created a problem, and they are like China in the sense that they're like the middle power surrounded by a bunch of other powers, right? Mm-hmm. The paradox there is you're insecure, so you want to be stronger, but if you build up too much, you freak everybody out. And under Xi Jinping, China is doing that. Now, China's smart strategy, the Bismarck in this analogy, was probably Deng Xiaoping, China's paramount leader in the 70s and 80s, who basically said, bide your time, hide your capabilities, which is basically like, let's grow as strong as possible before we come out of the box. I think the Chinese leadership has decided, wrongly in my view, that the Americans have clay feet after the financial crisis, after the Middle East debacles, the political consternation of recent years. They've decided that they don't need to worry. The difference between China and Germany is China is a lot stronger relative to the region than Germany was. So I think for us, the big lesson I take is actually measured strength and forward kind of deployment is preferable. So I think the mistake in both cases, and this is not a mistake of like moral culpability, although at some level it does have that, but really a strategic miscalculation was, I think World War I might not have happened, or maybe would not have happened, if the Germans had really understood that the British would be there and would fight from the beginning. If they had seen that, they would have understood they couldn't knock out France and that it would have failed. And that's sort of my logic is the best deterrent is if the other guy understands not only he's going to lose a lot, but it's ultimately going to fail. And that's, you know, the British had their long tradition, longer than ours, of splendid isolation, you know, which they'd started to move off of, but they didn't have any forces deployed on the continent. They had a small army. And so the Germans apparently even wondered whether the British would come in. I think they basically reckoned that they would once they decided to go through Belgium, but they figured they would wrap up the war, the fait accompli, which I'm very worried about, before the British would make a difference. Similarly for us, and when I was back in college, I was actually quite sympathetic to the Henry Cabot Lodge kind of position, the anti-League of Nations. And I think politically that was right. I mean, the League of Nations was kind of delusional in a sort of collective security way. But it would have been a lot better if we had stayed in Europe, you know, with a robust, not huge force. Hitler was, now we look back and we think Hitler was always maximally aggressive, but that's not actually how he was in the 20s and 30s. I mean, he rolled the dice in the Rhineland. He rolled the dice in Czechoslovakia. He rolled the dice in Austria. Yeah. And it worked for him. And I think, you know, the lesson there is, you know, and Walt and you know, I like John Mearsheimer a lot. I mean, but I mean, their argument in the Foreign Affairs article a few years ago is that we the Americans benefited from the collapse of Europe. But I actually think that's not right. I'm not sure John would, I don't know if Steve Wald personally, but I'm not sure mm-hmm. John would hold to that. I mean, from an American self-interest, we want as few of our people to die as possible. It's better if there are other countries doing the balancing work locally. And the Europeans essentially destroyed themselves, which America's not about geopolitics. I think geopolitically, but I'm trying to think geopolitically so we don't have to be defined by geopolitics.
It's really interesting, you know, keeping with the World War I analogy. And I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but it is very true around the strategic ambiguity with Britain. And if you really want to go, I mean, what had happened right before World War I with the British, the Boer War, where they did not do very well. And the German general staff was like, hey, look, these guys aren't that great. In a land war, you could point to Iraq and Afghanistan. But at the same time, and you know, this a lot of this actually does remind me of some like Japanese general staff thinking back in 1941, where they were like, yeah, you know, they've put us in the box and they've taken our oil and like we have no choice. Like we have to come and have this knockout blow. Yamamoto famously, you know, has the sleeping giant quote. What exactly has caused at least current CCP leadership, Xi Jinping? I can't speak to the Chinese military, but I assume that they're downstream of kind of the political thought. What are they not seeing that you're seeing? Because there is a doomer case here, but for many Americans who are like, God, look at this country. Joe Biden is president. Before that, it was Trump. It was like, this is a total disaster. You know, our domestic politics are a mess. you know, there's no way we can beat the Chinese. They're banning video games while our kids are wearing masks and like barely graduating from college. So what do you see in the strategic like center of gravity for the American people to say, no, guys, like if you screw with us, it's going to be really bad for you? Why do they not see that right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually was having this debate with this guy who's in the Biden NSC now. This guy Rush Doshi has an important new book out.
We know Rush.
Yeah, like a year ago, I had this back and forth with him about it. And it's a great question, and I do think honestly that we have a lot of problems that we need to draw, primarily for their own sake, but also from a kind of a geopolitical and strategic perspective. But I think what they're miscalculating, and I think a couple things I would say. One is, I think the Chinese are, first of all, it's possible they're nervous. I mean, my friend like Dan Blumenthal at AEI will tell you that they've got clay feet. I don't really buy that fully. I think the Chinese will continue growing probably, but there is that possibility. The Chinese know they're weak, they're going to have problems. And this is their window of opportunity. So they move now, even though they think we're not. Maybe they don't really think we have such terrible problems. It seems like they do. I think there's a self-image perspective here. I mean, look, it's an authoritarian, top-down Leninist system. Xi Jinping has really brought back personal rule. I mean, that wasn't clear. The sort of Deng Xiaoping and after model was much more consultative and consensus-oriented. And that, I think, was more conservative, small c, more incremental. Xi has brought forth like this whole idea of, you know, I mean, to go back to Hitler a little bit, you know, the leader principle, right? Yeah. And that's not how we work. And so there's a sort of orderliness aspect, a top-down, a discipline aspect that I think is heavily imbued in Chinese political culture, probably in general in the communist era, maybe even farther back, and certainly under Xi Jinping. And then you look at us and we're chaos and so forth, and everybody's shouting at each other and saying terrible things about each other. And, you know, people, one side says our president's a fascist, other side saying the president's, you know, a communist or whatever. I think, you know, there's an interesting quote by a guy named Michael Pettis a while ago, just in January, actually. Mm-hmm. He's a well-regarded, if kind of unorthodox economist who's actually based in Beijing. But he said, look, there's a possible the Chinese are feeling their oats right now. They think they've got everything figured out and the Americans are a basket case. Well, maybe the Americans are working it out. I mean, I think that's my semi-optimistic case is like, well, I kind of believe in democracy partially because, well, first of all, I think sort of morally people should be able to kind of chart their own fate, but also because, hey, it's out there. You know, we're going to hash it out. Meanwhile, their system, you know, in the shorter term, it moves clearly, but it's very brittle. And it's got, you know, you're not necessarily going to see it if you like ripped an iceberg through your under the waterline. So I think that's possible. And I think they don't see our those reserves of strength underneath the kind of frenetic political quality. So I think that's probably what's going on. And then the rhetoric that comes out, particularly the elite sort of center left media about how like it's the end of the world and all this kind of exaggeration, that I think plays into their assessments. The thing that I point out to people, I mean, the Europeans, you know, I was on with a French interviewer a couple of months ago and she said, well, you know, Bill Maher says that America is, you know, silly, you know, and we are all thinking America's silly. I was like, well, you know, we're growing at like twice your rate. So you're barely, you know, your economies are completely stagnant. So excuse us, but you know, you've always thought we were silly. So what's new? But you know, the cover of The Economist, which, you know, for good or ill, a few months ago was like, there's two major engines of global growth, the United States and China. So I think it's basically the world's going to come down to largely those two with some other big, you know, Uranus and Neptune out there, but two Jupiters basically.
I'd like you to speak to how great power conflict and the competition with China will reshape the U.S. military. Because another thing, I'm just taking this opportunity to just throw all my frustrations. I don't tweet much, so I'm saving it for here.
Okay.
There's this whole rhetoric of America can't win wars. That's the lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think what's happening there is you're seeing folks who are too granularly focused on the specific styles of wars that we're not particularly good at versus the kind that we actually are good at. So for example, 2003 Iraq, wow, right? That was really, really excellent. 2001 Afghanistan, combining CIA assets with like innovative drones, light footprints, tribal allies with the Northern Alliance, very good at that. I like to joke that the same people who because of political reasons, dunk on H.R. McMaster. Like, look at H.R. McMaster as a tank commander in Desert Storm and ask why not this person knows how to win battles. The point is that the style of warfare that we engaged in after 2001 and after 2003, that is the style where it's actually political. It's not a question of how many people can you defeat. It's a question of, can you get the Iraqis to reconcile? Can you construct an Afghan state? This is where your Burkean point is very important. Now that we're focusing on the China conversation, it's like you said, high technology, naval power, a reconfigured air force. Can you speak to how the Army, Marine Corps, Air Force, Navy that most of our audience has grown used to is basically going to look fundamentally different over the course of the next 20 years than it did over the past 20 years?
Yeah, well, I hope it changes. I mean, I think you're exactly right, Marshall. I mean, I think, look, we're not good at nation building. I'm not sure anybody's good at nation building. But if you're going to be an imperialist, you got to be ruthless and cynical. And we just aren't. I mean, that's my takeaway. The people, the real argument against the defense contractor kind of thing is people actually believed it at the Coalition Provisional Authority. They thought all the Iraqis would want to have a democracy, like just, you know, basically like in the U.S. I mean, I'm simplifying.
Which is scarier than the defense contractor.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's way worse.
Yeah,
it's exactly.
Like, you know, yeah. I mean, no culture. And you kind of knew the culture, but it was always in the context of sort of like a, you know, the ethnic parade kind of thing that I'm talking about, or, you know, once a year you put on your ethnic robes or whatever, instead of actually being deeply rooted. So that, look, we're bad at that. And that's, it's always been that. We were not good at that in Vietnam and so forth. Frankly, ground warfare in general, it's never been our strong suit. I mean, we're essentially kind of an island in the geopolitical context. To go back to another analogy, our position is a little bit like England was, or Great Britain was in Europe in the early much of the modern period. That's kind of how we are. And we're a democracy. When we're very rich. So our best is high technology, things where that kind of dominates. Ground warfare often, even in the modern era, can often come down to, you know, guys on the ground with guns duking it out. I mean, I'm not the world's expert by any stretch, but I think, you know, our army is very good, has a lot of capability. But the thing that really matters in what I'm talking about dealing with China is naval warfare and aerospace, and I'm talking air up into outer space. That is our wheelhouse, and we've lost the bubble on that. I mean, one of the things when I talk to military audiences, I often say, look. In this day and age, the famous movies people watch about the military are about Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. But what we really want is to go back to the 1980s, where the most famous movie about the military was about a guy going to training school, Top Gun.
Yep.
Right? I mean, that's what people should be going and doing, is training their butts off to go toe-to-toe with the best of the best of the best, to quote, you know, Iceman or whoever said it in Top Gun. But I think that's what we want. But that is where we're good. That can be extraordinarily dangerous, especially if nuclear weapons become involved, not only over there, but at home. But that is what we're good at. And I was struck. I was watching that recent remake of the Midway movie, which, you know, is pluses and minuses. But I was kind of trolling around on Wikipedia afterwards. And you know, I mean, that couple of things, that was, we were actually outnumbered and kind of an outgunned in a lot of ways. And, you know, 75 years ago. But I mean, that's the straight linear tradition to today's Navy. They won fair and square decisively, and that was through things that the Navy has continued to cultivate, you know, inventiveness, technology, skill, courage, et cetera. Those are sort of, that shows our wheelhouse. And I think that's what we need. And we need to get back that, and we need our military to change accordingly. The problem is a lot of people don't want to do that. And one of the things I really think is critical coming out of the Afghanistan context is that not only that the Biden administration get all the scrutiny and opprobrium that it deserves for this mishandling of the withdrawal, but also that the dominant sort of set within the military over the last 20, 25 years has been the coinistas, basically, the people who've made their names in the Middle East. And honestly, at the end of the day,
can you explain, Rachel, this is actually very important.
Yeah, explain
we haven't done an insurgency. Can you explain like the counterinsurgency? Because this was a huge thing 10 years ago.
Yeah. So 10, 15 years ago, there was this whole idea that there was a kind of science of how to do counterinsurgency. Basically, if you're in, you know, you go into the Middle East, you go into some kind of area where there's chaos and disorder and insurgency, you've got this book called Counterinsurgency or the Science, and you can apply it and you do ink blots and you do pacification, and ultimately you'll be able to get to a good place. And of course, the greatest example of this was kind of the apotheosis of the surge and this sort of thing. And the strong case was, we know how to do this. We can do this. We can go around into the developing world and impose basically have satisfactory outcomes. And I think what we've seen over the last 10 years is that's manifestly false, especially in Afghanistan. But I don't think Iraq has anything to write home about either, given the costs that we've incurred over it, both human, financial, and geopolitical. So I think that's, but coming out of Afghanistan, it's really important that that be internalized and understood and scrutinized, that, you know, it's not personal, is not the primary thing, but that the whole kind of ascendancy of the people who were all about counterinsurgency and the wars in the Middle East. I mean, at the end of the day, not only did Afghanistan fall apart, but apparently they were surprised. I mean, General Milley was surprised.
Right.
Is that possible? How good are we at this? Not good. And we don't need it, you know? So it's like we need a new generation, a new type of leader in the military who has different orientations, focused on a great power competition and this kind of high-end warfare in particular that's designed to defend our exposed allies there.
Can you just reiterate then, in the post-Afghan reprioritization, we're talking about naval power, aerospace, and how do we prevent that from becoming a quote-unquote like boondoggle with the military-industrial complex, if you're going to accept, you know, the reality of such things? Because I easily foresee, you know, more F-35 programs, more, you know, and look, I'm very pro Space Force, but, you know, I haven't seen a pretty ambitious project yet that has come out of it. I had, the last time I checked, the Navy's new I don't think it's called a destroyer, but they didn't make enough so that it costs $1 million a round to fire their fancy new guns. Like, we don't seem particularly adept at playing in this new sphere either. So what does that look like in terms of the reprioritization?
Yeah, there's malevolence and malfeasance, but a lot of this is structural. I mean, is the kind of the regulatory environment that you know, our procurement process has to go through, you know, everything has to be checked down to the nines, all this kind of, you know, a kind of risk-averse approach. I'm skeptical that we'll be able to radically improve our technology point. I mean, I know some of the big tech names like Eric Schmidt are out there calling for that. And that's, you know, while I'm very sympathetic to the pushback on the social media companies, I do think Schmidt is right about that, which is to say we need our defense establishment to leverage the technology that we are, you know, as a country are creating and cultivating. I think to your point about the military-industrial complex, I mean, this is another point. Like back 10 years ago, there were Republican coalition for increasing defense spending. And I was never that enthusiastic about it. I mean, my preference would be to spend as little as possible on defense. But I think we're at a point now where we're at this kind of Germany point where like we got to spend now so we don't have to spend later, both in blood and money. And again, I think, you know, I think the defense companies are not, you know, they're going to do what they're told. Ultimately, they have their influence, but it's, you know, it's akin to the influence of other corporations and so forth in American life, which is, you know, significant, but it's something that's just in the nature of an advanced society. And so they deserve scrutiny and so forth. But, you know, what I'm hoping is that we can get the system to adapt. The problem is the system hasn't adapted enough. So when I was in the Pentagon and the Trump administration, I, you know, led the development of the National Defense Strategy of 2018, which did try to orient in this direction. But there has been some progress, but not fast enough. You know, and China may have an incentive, as I think I said earlier, to move this decade. And, you know, there's a lot of congressional districts that have certain factories, so it's hard to retire old weapons. And we just don't have time anymore. So I think, you know, I think the main problem we have right now is that we might lose a war to China, and we can clean up on the military industrial complex side as we do that. And it's an important issue, but I think that can't be our primary focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the perfect lead up to my last big question here, which is how do we, I was asking you, what should we learn from history? What should we learn from analogies? Let's focus then on ideas, because full disclosure, everyone, obviously, I work at the Hudson Institute. I do a podcast there. I know a lot of the criticism of like Raytheon and the spending comes down to, are you all just pumping your own books, basically? And the thing that I want to emphasize here is that I actually believe what I believe. Sagar, you believe what you believe. And Bridge, you believe what you believe. And if you actually look at the history of this Cold War era, if you're looking at most of the things that people are really dissatisfied, it's not going to be a lobbyist having a sketchy dinner. It's actually going to be very specific ideas that very specific people held in good faith that led to your disaster. So if you're wondering, okay, why is it that we didn't have enough troops when we invaded Iraq in 2003? Well, that's because there was this idea called the revolution in military affairs, which led people like Donald Rumsfeld to believe that the same technology piece could be applied, misapplied to a ground context where it didn't actually belong. And that, once again, wasn't a weapons contract. And actually, many weapons contractors were very unhappy with what Donald Rumsfeld was doing. The first big thing that Donald Rumsfeld did when he entered in the Pentagon is he canceled this massive post-Cold War artillery system that we literally didn't need. And funnily enough, he was actually brought in to say nice things about 2000 George W. Bush. He was actually brought in to be the big businessman who's going to cut and slice and all those big things there. So once again, it wasn't an industrial complex. It were ideas that people actually held. Counterinsurgency. It's all these things here. How do we prevent, to sort of check yourself, this framework and this idea around competition with China from going too far? Yeah. Because that seems to be my lesson of the post-Cold War era. Ideas held by people in good faith consistently went too far and they led to disaster. So apply that to your own thinking here.
Oh, that's a great question. I think about that sometimes. I mean, I think they're conscious of the time. I think there are a number of ways you could take it. I would say, look, and this sounds a little bit corny, but I think it's true. It always should come back to the interests of the American people. I mean, the America First tag was obviously is flawed because of its association with the 1930s. I mean, apropos of what we've been talking about. But the idea that we should always be putting front and center American citizens' interests, you know, in a conceived in an enlightened way that's not zero sum all the time, but, you know, in a real way, that's what it should be about. So for instance, like a lot of, I'm sort of on the less ideological side of the sort of, you know, this new strategic competition with China. Many of the people I agree with on a lot of things think, hey, we got to turn China into a liberal democracy. Hey, we got to be up there on the barricades everywhere all the time, making sure that there's democracy in Myanmar and stuff. My view is like, not really, because how does that achieve our goal? And the goal being a sustainable interest for America. We wish the best, you know, if you go back to the John Quincy Adams, you know, we wish the best for people abroad who are thirsting for liberty, but that's their job to vindicate it ultimately. Sometimes it may be useful for us to do that. And if it is in the interest of the American people to do that, we should. It often might be. But I don't think it's right for us to ask for Americans to die or pay a lot of money or risk their necks, et cetera, their kids' necks to go out on these sort of crusades. And I think that's the sort of, that's how I try to check myself, is like coming back again to the sort of, look, what's in regular Americans' interests? And I think, you know, frankly, that's not often the way the blob works. And I mean, again, the blob is, look, they're, you need an expert class. I mean, there will always be elites, right? The point is to have elites working on the right things and in the right direction for the right purposes, in my view. And I think the problem often with the blob is that the real incentives for the blob are, you know, they're often patronized by people who don't reflect, don't really agree with the interests as I've laid them out. So they don't really, they regard their job often as kind of patronizing to the American people and saying, well, you need to understand that we need to stand up for liberty and blah, blah, blah. And we should double our spending on defense and these kind of absurdities. And it's like, well, who do you work for? Like, my view is ultimately we should be working for the American people, right? And again, I sound like I'm running for office, but I'm not. But I actually, like, that's what motivates me. That's why I think what I do is useful and not just a kind of a parlor game, is because I really think what I'm trying to do is help Americans not get killed and save money and raise their families in a good way. That I hope that's what I'm trying to do. So that's what I try to do to keep myself in check. But yeah, others,
that's really,
we need checks and balances all over. So
agreed. That's really well said. Bridge, we're going to have a link to the book in the description where people can purchase it. Is there anywhere else that you want to direct people to?
Well, I mean, you could direct them to our my partner, good friend, Wes Mitchell, and I have a small think tank, new think tank or policy initiative called the Marathon Initiative.
Great.
www.themarathoninitiative.org. And just because Marshall said it, we actually decided not to accept money from defense contractors and foreign sources. I agree with Marshall. I don't think it makes a big difference, but that's the perception out there. But so just so people know.
Perception is important. It certainly is. At least nobody will ever write it in some profile. Really enjoy this conversation. Really appreciate your view. I think it's about as close to mine as kind of exists in the foreign policy professional sphere now. So thank you very much, Bridge. I hope everybody goes out there and buys the book. And, you know, I'm sure we'll have you back on the show. So thank you.
Delighted to. Thanks, guys. Really enjoyed it.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.